Hello everybody, welcome to another episode of the RJK podcast, where we explore the big questions shaping our lives, society, and the world we live in. Today, we're diving into one of the most profound and universal topics, living a meaningful life. I'm thrilled to introduce my guest, Dr. Simon Vogt, a philosopher, educator, writer, and passionate advocate for philosophical activism. Dr. Simon holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of St. Andrews, Scotland, and currently lectures at HTW Berlin. He has authored numerous academic papers in various fields like aesthetics, applied ethics, and metaphilosophy. Today, Simon will help us explore what it means to live a meaningful life and why this timeless topic is particularly crucial in our modern era. Simon, welcome to the RJK podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited for this conversation.
Likewise, thank you very much for joining today. Simon, before we dive in, what sparked your interest in studying philosophy and building a career in this field? Was it a particular thinker, a personal experience, or simply an academic pursuit?
I was quite interested in kind of questioning, you know, like when you grow up as a kid, maybe you sometimes take things for granted and sometimes you just go like, but why is it like this? Why should we, you know, follow life the way everyone tells us? And I've always been this kid. I've always been the kid who kind of reads a lot of books and wants to know why is it that we're doing the things that we're doing the way we're doing them rather than something else. When I went to high school, when I was really kind of 16, 17, we did have a little bit of philosophy that was introduced to us during literature classes. I got quite excited. I remember discovering Nietzsche then and going like, oh my God, this guy is genius. Let's do this. I have since discovered much more, of course. And as I went on to university, I decided to pursue philosophy. As with many of those things, I turned out to be pretty good at it. So I went on and continued to do a PhD as well.
That's great. It's for sure a very interesting field indeed, and I have personal interest in it, although I haven't studied philosophy, but I read a lot of philosophy and I read like philosophical books. So anyway, let's crack on in our topic for today. The philosopher and cognitive scientist John Vervaeke describes what he calls the meaning crisis, a modern struggle where many people today feel disconnected and anxious because we've lost traditional ways of finding purpose and significance in life. So, Simon, do you believe our society is currently experiencing a meaning crisis?
Yeah, I think that's totally on point. Absolutely. I think that there are a lot of meanings that we were given as humans in the past through various kind of either ideologies or religions or other kind of sources of shared meaning that humans had across different societies, across different groups. And this has been significantly eroded in the recent decades, in the recent years. I already mentioned Nietzsche. He already said that, you know, God is dead, but God is dead because we killed him. That was the whole quote is that, like, because humans have kind of dethroned religion, you know, humans have decided largely that maybe we don't need to believe absolutely everything we're told and all this. Like, we kind of decided that this universal source of meaning, the one that was meant to be given externally and given to us and we just follow it, is just no more. And I think that this was just the beginning. This was just the beginning of a onslaught of authorities of various sorts, of kind of dethroning of lots of different ideologies. I think that the 20th century has contributed to this massively because so many of the ideologies that people believed in for so long turned out to be really bankrupt. Morally bankrupt because of, you know, the rise and horrible things that have been done by nationalisms, for example, a big the ideology that motivated people, gave people meaning, you know, a great deal of other kinds of things that people were really committed to, like traditional family values, for example, or traditional views on how you should develop your career and life. And these have been challenged massively over the 20th century by various critical movements who have pointed out that many of those ideologies are actually not that great for everyone, maybe. And thus, the kind of very universal sources of meaning that we had have all become a bit questioned, and people just don't follow them as much as they used to. And I think on top of this, we have witnessed a massive increase in the types and powerful technologies that we're using right now that basically have given us so many ways to distract ourselves and so many ways to kind of fill our time without actually looking for anything meaningful in our lives. And I think that this effectively means that people are kind of just a bit too busy having fun to pursue meaningful things. And then at some point they wake up and go like, oh, actually, I've kind of not done anything meaningful in my life and I don't know how to right now. But I'd be really excited to talk about all of that with you in more detail.
For sure, for sure. And again, you know, there is a meaning crisis, but, you know, let's maybe take a couple steps back and then try to define what actually is a meaningful life. So how would you define a meaningful life in the traditional sense? And that's more important. Is it something that is universal or that's something personal?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is yes, which means that it can be either. And I think that throughout history, people have found meaning in life in one of two ways, either from some sort of external sources of meaning, or they have found it internally. And external sources of meaning can be things like religions or ideologies or cultures, nations. I don't know, people can believe in destiny or things like this. And then they believe that this kind of meaning of their life is given to them by something external, be it by God or be it by, you know, the duty to your nation, or be it by some sort of, yeah, belief in some sort of destiny or, I know, cosmic order or something like this, right? And like I said, in the recent centuries and definitely the recent decades, we have been doing a lot to deconstruct a lot of those things and kind of say that, well, all those things that you thought were universal that God has given you or that, you know, are really great because our whole nation shares it and things like this, are actually not that great. Maybe they're a bit questionable. Maybe they privilege some people over other people, for example. Maybe they lead to wars. Maybe they end up...
That's identity politics, right?
Exactly, like, right? That is very much kind of the criticism of society that the liberal world order of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century has brought. It has been largely about... yeah, questioning those kind of received wisdoms about what is worth something in life. And it has been done for very often very with very good intentions, because it has been done with the intention of freeing those people who have been disadvantaged by these sort of ideas, right? If I have a religion that says that my people are the best people, or that this is the way to achieve salvation, then in all likelihood, it's, you know, makes me not that great for people who are not my people, or maybe for people who want to live their lives differently, for example. So then in the service of helping those people, we would question these sort of systems. But when these sort of sources of meaning are external to us, then they only hold weight when we really believe in them, when we really think that this has been something that is really trustworthy, something that is good, something that we should follow, right? Once they are questioned, then we kind of lose them a bit. But at the same time, people can have internal sources of meaning, right? They can just decide how to live their own meaningful life. And in the history of philosophy, the most radical movement that has been promoting this sort of thinking was existentialism. So that's the beginning of the 20th century, mostly in France. Philosophers such as Jean-Pierre Schott have been talking about how life is meaningless. There is no such thing as the meaning of life. You know, life is absurd in a way. I mean, I like to say that as well when people sometimes ask me what is the meaning of life. You know, on the biological sense, the meaning of life is to live long enough to reproduce. That's it. Anything beyond that, we make up. Okay? And that is the kind of view that the existentialists would have. I'm not necessarily associating with this, but basically for them, this is the idea, right? We have this universe that is absolutely indifferent to us. There is no such thing as destiny. There is no such thing as God who tells us how to live our lives. And everything else is just made up. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. They would see that as a potentially a good thing, because that means that we are free to choose any meanings we want. We can live our lives authentically, true to ourselves, and not kind of follow some sort of meanings that are given to us from outside. But we can make meanings that mean something to us. Something that really is, you know, meaningful to every single person. Now, naturally, That sort of thinking works for some people better than it works for others. Some people need a bit more guidance, some people don't need guidance. And in many cases, perhaps having limited options is also a good thing. You know, if you go to a supermarket and you have an aisle with, I know, 200 different types of juice, and you go like, I just want a juice. I don't want to choose all these things all the time. I just want to be given something and just told that this is the right thing to do. And we have so much choice right now that people quite often would be in the situation in which they go like, well, did I choose the best life? Maybe I didn't. If the choice is from a million options, I have doubts. If I only had three options to choose from, then I go like,
oh, it's easier.
That makes it easier, right? So those are okay. These kind of two, let's say, opposing, you know, poles of this. Either the meaning is completely given to you from outside, or the meaning is something that you just need to make up yourself. There's nothing else, right? And I think that when you look at philosophy in general as a discipline or like intellectual endeavor, it's something that's trying to find something in the middle a little bit, like limit those options a bit and say like, okay, there is technically an infinite number of options you could choose from, but let's talk about the ones that are actually good. Like, you know, the fact that we have a million options to choose from doesn't mean that all of them are good options. So let's think of what are the options that are actually good for us to live a meaningful life. And in this case, I quite like to go back to the ancient Greek philosophers, because in a way, I agree with Alfred Whitehead, who said that basically the best way to characterize Western philosophy is to say that it's a series of footnotes to Plato. So let's go back to Plato for just a second and say how in Plato's dialogues, the main character in Plato's dialogues is Socrates, who famously has said that an unexamined life is not worth living. And the idea is, it's kind of a bit harsh, not worth living. All right. It's like
an unexamined life.
Exactly. So okay. The idea is that you should, in order to find meaning in your life and meaning in the world and everything, you should start from examining your own life and thinking, how do I live my life? And knowing yourself. This is something that Socrates brings up in his Apologia. This is the defense then, and when he was sentenced to death, he was kind of telling how he lived his life and how he decided is the most sensible way to live life. And he was talking about this dictum that was
engraved.
Engraved. Oh, thank you. On top of the Oracle of Apollo in Delphi, which said, "Know thyself." And this was, he said,
it's a famous saying, right?
Exactly.
Know thyself.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is what he built this whole idea that you should really know yourself and know what it is about you that, you know, means that you have some place in the world that, you know, kind of allows you to develop as well, allows you to find your spot in the society and with everyone else. And with this examination of your own life and what is your place in it, you can adopt this kind of ever-growing self-improvement ethos that Plato was always promoting as well. That he always said that humans shouldn't be the kind of creatures who just are. Humans should always be becoming something better, because we can always improve, right?
Okay.
And then in the philosophy of Aristotle, we find a really excellent way to kind of systematize how we should do that. And Aristotle was talking about the life of eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is usually translated into English as flourishing, or human fulfillment, something like this.
Uh-huh.
And he associated this with a life of virtue, a life in which we hone such virtues in us as wisdom, courage, I know, temperance, justice, things like this.
So these are the Stoic virtues as well.
Absolutely. So the Stoics took it later from Aristotle as well. And when Marcus Aurelius, for example, is writing about this, he's referring absolutely to Aristotle as well. But it's not only the Greeks who would think of that sort of stuff. If you travel half the world, you know, go to China, Confucius was talking about fairly similar things in a way. It's also kind of very focused on self-improvement, virtue. Maybe in Confucianism, there's a bit more emphasis of the kind of community and relationships and social harmony rather than it's a bit less individualistic, let's say. But it's a fairly common idea. And this already gives us a little bit of structure to all of this freedom of choosing meanings in life, right? We should choose the sort of life that allows us to develop our virtue. And this is what will give a part of what will give meaning to our life, right? We will become a wise person. We will become a just person. We will become a person who, with their courage and justice and wisdom and whatever else, will help the others to create a better society, a better community, a better life for your polis, as the Greeks would say, so for your city. But we would probably say for, you know, for our nations, for our neighbors, for our communities of any sort, right?
It's interesting how, what you just mentioned has many layers. Like, you're starting from the self, then the community, then the country, then the world, maybe. So it looks like meaning has multiple levels of contribution levels of actions, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And you can develop it on all of those levels at the same time. I think this is probably one of the better ways to approach this as well. And kind of proceeding with this, I don't know, what's the better, honor used to be the word that people would have used in the past. Right now, we'd probably use the word integrity more. Kind of doing what's right, regardless whether it's kind of good for you, right? But just doing it what's right for...
Doing the right thing, yeah.
Exactly, right? And I think right now, this is actually an excellent thing to follow. I am actually really trying to promote this in my own writing as well, because I think that today's world is full of all sorts of injustices or other kind of sufferings that different communities in the world suffer from. And there is so much for us to do to, create a better world, not just for ourselves, but also for others. And I think that perhaps this is also what makes it a bit difficult to find this meaning, because our Western culture in the recent decades has been so focused on individualism, on doing the things that are good for yourself, being happy, you're worth everything and everyone should receive, prizes for everything all this time. But actually, it's not necessarily what gives us meaning, according to these sort of philosophies that I just mentioned. It's giving back to others that really gives us this sort of feeling like we do something worthwhile in the world.
I see. It's this sense of contribution as well, probably, right?
Absolutely. And you mentioned Stoics as well, and Stoics were definitely also very focused on pursuit of virtue and eudaimonia and all that. But that was always not for the sake of perfecting yourself for the sake of perfecting yourself, right? That's not the point. The point is you perfect yourself so that you can do something good for everybody else. When you read Marcus Aurelius, for example, and his Meditations, his prime objective was to be a good emperor, right? And it's a fascinating story of this as well, because I don't know if you or the listeners know the history of how this unfolded in the Roman Empire at the time, but basically before Marcus Aurelius, the emperor was Antoninus Pius, and before him it was Hadrian. And Hadrian was he had a temper. He would
emotional.
Yeah, exactly. He would get angry. He would really react emotionally and not make the best decisions for the empire in the views of Marcus Aurelius or other people as well. When he was superseded by Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius really admired Antoninus Pius. He said that this was kind of the model emperor who was actually really good for Rome, right? And he always wanted to be like him. Marcus Aurelius thought that he was not as good because he had trouble managing his own emotions. In particular, he had anger issues, and he was trying to learn to be better at it so that he can be as good as emperor as Antoninus Pius and never fall down the same trap that Hadrian fell down, becoming this, having this temper that actually was really bad. But the point is, it was really bad for whom? It was really bad for Rome, right? It was really bad for the people that he wanted to serve. So he very much launched himself on this massive journey of self-improvement that was in which he wrote the Meditations and did a lot of studying of Stoic philosophy, because he wanted to perfect himself so that he can be a better emperor and better serve his people. And once again, it's kind of not for your own sake that you're doing this, right? You're doing it for the sake of others.
Okay, I see. So there's not only a selfish element or egoistic element in that pursuit, but rather it should be done for the benefits of others at the end. This is kind of the end result. This is how it becomes truly meaningful.
I think so. And, this is also something that is very much confirmed by modern psychology. So there's a number of studies in which people have asked those who are in palliative care. So people who are on their deathbeds, basically, people who know that they have cancer, they will die in half a year, right? And they would ask, the researchers would ask them, what do you wish you did in your life? Or what are the things you're most happy with? What are the things that, you know, you regret? You regret, yeah. Right? And of those people, I mean, nobody regrets that they didn't make another million, you know? Nobody regrets that they didn't have a new Porsche or something like this, right? What people do regret is that they did not make a more meaningful impact on their community, for example, right? People also absolutely regret the fact that they have not
wronged someone or missed a relationship or something like that.
Exactly, right? And it's so focused on human relationships and giving back. Very often people really, really find this the most meaningful. There's also studies on happiness. And there is two types of happiness that researchers usually distinguish. There's this kind of happiness in the moment, or like, you know, if you eat a bar of chocolate right now, it makes you really happy, right? You're really happy. But if I ask you in 2 weeks' time, are you happy you ate, you know, 10 bars of chocolate last week? You'll go like, actually, I'm probably not very happy, right? So it's this kind of happiness in the moment and the happiness looking back at your life, like, was that actually good choices, right? And when it comes to the latter type, the thing that gives people the most life satisfaction is exactly this, is exactly knowing that they have helped somebody else, that they have, I know, mentored somebody who has become a great student of theirs, for example, that they have launched a meaningful project that helped people in some way, that they have contributed to their community and all sorts of things like this.
I see. Okay, Simon, going back now to the meaning crisis, how is that crisis affecting individuals and societies today? I know you touched already briefly on that, but let's kind of go into more details. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the increase in depression rates that we see, maybe caused by technology. So I'm sure that the environment has a lot to do, and the technological advancements have caused partly or significantly that impact. But can we talk a bit about what are like the common aspects and ways that individuals today are being affected by that crisis?
Absolutely. I think that there is one thing that we already mentioned is kind of excess of freedom. We have so much freedom right now that there is more and more responsibility on the individual to choose the right path. And sometimes it's not that easy to choose the right path. It's not that easy to know what is the meaningful thing for you. And because of this, I think a lot of people end up paralyzed, right? When it's, this is a psychological phenomenon as well, the choice paralysis. I'm not sure if you are aware of this as well, but it's basically...
I'm a marketing professional, so there has been done some studies on that in marketing as well. So people don't buy or end up not buying if you give them too many choices.
Exactly, right? And it's kind of the same with life. If you have so many choices, people just go like, I don't know what to do, and just hide somewhere, right? And it's really kind of ironic, because the increase in the amount of choice that we had was always very well-intentioned. This is giving you more liberty, more options, more opportunities, remove the oppressions that are stopping you from doing things, right? These are all fantastic things. But perhaps, as often with like the pendulum of history, it swings a little bit too far for its own good. It's also, in a way, like we mentioned before, it was a swing away from those external meanings, the meanings that are given to us and that limit us, because they have a nasty tendency to advantage some people over others, right? So in recent history, we wanted to tear those down and give people more freedom. And instead of giving people instructions on how to live their life and how to have meaning in this life, we just said, you can do absolutely anything you want, just don't do those things that are bad for others, right?
Okay.
So you give people those negative guidelines, what not to do, but you don't give them positive guidelines.
I see what you mean, yes.
And I think that in this case, many people are just a bit lost, because this is a system that works potentially really good for those of us who really actually want to make up our own meanings and who really feel like this is, they're not so troubled by the amount of choice that we have. We can kind of potentially deal with it and stuff like this. But perhaps this doesn't work for everyone. And that's totally fine. You know, people have different approaches to life. I don't know if you're familiar with the famous anecdote of Barack Obama wearing exactly the same suit every day, right? Or something like
that. No, I don't know. Maybe you can.
Right. So apparently he said at some point that he has to make so many important choices every day.
Yeah,
that he just experiences choice fatigue. And if he also had to make the choice of what to wear today, it's just too much. It's just like, remove those things from my life. So I'm just going to wear the same thing every single day.
And so he buys the same suits?
Exactly. So he would have like 10 versions of exactly the same suit and just wear exactly the same thing every day.
I see.
And in a way, you can see how this is, you know, a very valid technique, right? When you experience too much of this choice fatigue, you might want to reduce it. And I imagine that, not all of us are as, crafty and intelligent and great as Barack Obama was. So maybe for us, this like level is not, you know, making so many decisions for the country, right? Maybe it's already at the slightly lower level that we'd experience this sort of thing. And that's totally fine. Also, you know, people might have different priorities. I mean, they might just not want to make those choices because they want to, I don't know, use their strengths and energies in other ways. And that's totally fine. So I think that part of why we experience this level of loss of meaning is just the fact that we have designed society in such a way that we need to make those choices and make this meaning up. And just not everyone is really that comfortable with this. And in a way, I think that also leads to some of the problems that you'll probably be also familiar with from the other side. We talked about technology and perhaps social media as well. And the fact that, once again, when you're given so much freedom, people tend to actually use this freedom to create those echo chambers, for example, to create those like closed environments in which they limit actually the choice. Yeah. And in a way, the social media kind of make it even worse because they make it really easy, since everyone has the freedom to decide what to believe and all this. Well, everyone can have their alternative facts and they can have their own truths and they can have their own echo chambers in which they have freely decided to limit themselves to a certain number of beliefs, because this allows them to kind of order their lives a little bit more.
So they can isolate themselves via social media by following certain content, certain accounts, right? That's what you mean?
Absolutely. And right now, I think that in a way, what we're observing is a resurgence of people making this, of trying to find this meaning in something new that was, because we kind of, like I said, we have torn down the meanings coming from religion or culture or universal cultures or things like this. And right now, it seems like a lot of people are finding this meaning in the culture war. Right? They're finding this meaning in being, for example, being woke or being anti-woke.
So by taking one side, that's kind of their new meaning. This gives them some sense of meaning.
Absolutely. And I think this is why potentially people become so militant about this. Because people like to believe in something. People like to have a cause. People like to have something to fight for because that gives them meaning in life.
And sorry to interrupt, but that's what happens when you remove the traditional sources of meaning, like what you said, ethics, religions, etc. When you remove these, there's a vacuum, right? And I think we as human beings are probably built with a need to have some meaning. So anything else could take that place, right?
That's exactly, yeah.
And it could be the wrong things.
And when you're in this situation in which we have created this vacuum because we have given everyone all this freedom to choose whatever they want, well, at some point, someone is going to show up and tell you what you should want. And I think this is exactly what is happening right now, right? And this is why we have such amazing, stunningly popular influencers who can get so much popularity because, well, at the end of the day, there are a lot of people who do want to be told what to do and who want to be given some sort of guidance. It's not a negative thing, right? I'm not wrong to say that like those are dumb people who cannot make up their own meaning. No, that's not true. Like, I think that all of us have a tendency to just have someone tell us which options are the good ones. Because
yeah, for sure. I mean, especially if you are younger in age, if you are not if you haven't completed your studies yet, I mean, it's natural for people to receive some guidance at every stages in their life, right? And the younger, maybe the more guidance they need. Yeah, I totally agree.
And so I'm in no way like judging people for any of this. And I think that it's just, it's high time for us to start thinking a bit more critically about this, maybe, and start thinking, okay, well, we need to make sure that we try to do something like those ancient philosophers were trying to do, like take all of this multitude of options and actually go to people and say like, all right, there's millions of options, but these ones are the good ones. So, you know, get rid of all the bad options. And, you know, the truth is that, well, you can, if you want something from people and you have the skill and power to manipulate them into choosing some options that are actually beneficial for you, then maybe you will do that, right? And maybe you will get those people to follow a certain meanings or certain agendas or something like this, not because it's good for them. You do it because it's good for you and you're just exploiting them effectively. So I think that one of the better things we should do in this respect is just to try and bring back some of those approaches of ancient philosophy that I was mentioning before.
I see. Simon, I wanted to ask you something about nihilism, and because you talked a little bit before about existentialism. And if a society or if certain members of society don't have a sense of meaning or are lost, as you just explained, would that generate nihilism within them? And would that actually cause them kind of to disappear, like, or collapse? Will society collapse if many members of that society start to believe that, you know, life is meaningless, there's no such thing as something meaningful in life? I wanted to hear a bit your comment about those two, about nihilism mainly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is not a theoretical question. I think this is happening. It's just not happening at the scale of entire society. But when you look at the notes that mass shooters are leaving, if you leave at the things that various guys who, you know, that suicide rates amongst men are much higher than amongst, or successful suicide rates, at least amongst men, are much higher than amongst women. And a lot of those people also do this because they don't see a point in living, right? They don't see a point in, and largely this is probably because they have lost some meanings in life, right? I think this is actually something that is particularly problematic for men right now, because in a way...
Before you continue. So you're saying that in recent times, suicide rates have gone up compared to previous periods in history?
I'm not sure exactly about the statistics. I think they have some areas, but what I was trying to say is, what I was trying to get into in here is that those rates are also much higher for men right now.
For men, specifically for men.
Exactly. And I think that this is partially tied to the fact that I think men have experienced this loss of meaning in life potentially a bit more in the recent decades. And the reason is that, well, A, women have had feminism, which has been a massive source of meaning for many women. And I don't necessarily care what you or any of your listeners think about it, but, you know, it has definitely given a lot of women a lot of drive and meaning in life. And men,
emancipation and drive and self-realization. This is a fact. It's true. But maybe as well, the extreme isn't good as well. I mean, everything in extremes isn't good, right?
The definition of too much is that it's bad for you. So, yes. And I think that, you know, men have not had something like this. And in fact, a lot of the things that have given men meaning in life on a very individual level, like, for example, being a provider of your family or you know, protecting your family from danger or something like this, have actually become less important. Because, you know, women earn money, you know, there isn't that much danger in most of our Western societies right now. So in many ways, those men who would have found this meaning, and, you know, perhaps they were not necessarily following a great religion, they were not necessarily national, you know, followers or something like this. That's not where they had their meaning, but they had their meaning in family life. And right now they struggle. And a lot of those men, and I think this is also an interesting statistic, that a lot of the men who do commit suicide or do things that kind of fall into what we call deaths of despair, right? So deaths from overdose, for example, accidents that happen because of stupid, actions, or like being unnecessarily risky and creating accidents or things like this. Those happen to men who don't have this sort of struggle to find this sort of meaning in life. They're disproportionately high to single men, for example, and disproportionately high to men who have somehow lost something that was giving them meaning, right? So people who have lost their jobs, people who, I know, have been to war, for example, and they came back and they couldn't find their place in society anymore. Nothing like this. So yes, this is definitely a problem with, why do I talk about it right now? Because you mentioned nihilism, and this is very much a nihilistic type of thinking, right? There is no point left in life. There is nothing for me that I can still do that will bring meaning, and this will not change. This is the type of thinking that nihilism would espouse. And the ultimate solution to pointlessness of life is just to end your life.
Oh, this is quite unfortunate. But again, going back to this as well, do you think in the revolution that happened, like with the Enlightenment, and then, as you said, people like societies putting aside traditional values and religions and spirituality in general, and this movement of liberation, do you think it was taken too far, and that's why today we are paying the price? Because some liberation is good to a certain extent. It is good. But then, as I said before, anything pushed to the extreme. So to rephrase again my question, do you think that this movement of liberation that came with the Enlightenment, starting from the Enlightenment, whereby they started to put aside all the traditional values and started to open up to believe in science, to believe in naturalistic explanations only, do you think this is a direct cause of why we are living what we are living today?
I think that this is probably one of the big underlying mechanisms. However, Immanuel Kant wrote this fantastic essay called What is Enlightenment? And in the beginning of this essay, I think, how does he start it? Enlightenment is humanity freeing itself from self-imposed puberty. Or something like this. So basically, it is the moment in which humanity starts thinking for itself. So again, it's like, rather than take those meanings that your parents have given you, or religion, or whatever else has given you, you start thinking for yourself, making up your own meanings, right? So in a way, if you interpret it like this, yes, it would be it would lay some sort of groundwork for it. But I think that Enlightenment was at the same time very, very much a movement that was focused on structure, right? So it wasn't necessarily removing any guidance or any meanings. It was rather replacing certain arbitrary meanings, or what it saw like arbitrary meanings. So, for example, religion, and replacing it with science, right? Science is an excellent source of meaning as well. Or replacing it also with the idea of a nation state. Remember that nation state and nationalism is also a product of Enlightenment, right? So it's not that clear cut. But I think in a way the roots are probably there, right? But I think that you mentioned like the way some things can become too much or go too far. There is the silly saying that humans always find the right way to do things, but only after they tried all of the wrong ways first.
Yeah, you're right.
It's quite often like this, right? So the pendulum is swinging, and eventually it will zone in on where it should go. And coming back to Aristotle again, he had this idea of the golden middle, right? So that everything that's virtuous is kind of in the middle between the vice of excess and the vice of deficiency. I think that in a way you could see as history as kind of also doing this kind of excess deficiency, and maybe eventually zoning in on something that's right. Perhaps right now, this is also what's happening. We are definitely living through a beginning of a anti-liberal backlash. Conservatism around the world is on the rise. And many people would say that this is perhaps because the liberal world order has kind of gone a bit too far for some people. I'm not sure if I would necessarily agree with this. It's not for me to make this judgment. I think that for anyone who is situated in a given point in history, It's for the historians in 100 years to tell us which way things have gone. But I think that it is fair to say that as liberalism was swinging us in one direction, it failed to provide meanings that people need and that would replace those old meanings that it has torn down. So I don't necessarily think that giving us all of those freedoms, coming back to your question, right, or like questioning like some world orders that were privileging some people over others and all that is a bad thing. But I do think that as you go around the world, you know, tearing down all of those walls that are preventing us from getting the things that we want and limiting our freedom and all that, you must also look at the fact that maybe those walls were like supporting a structure of people's, I know, lives or something. And maybe you cannot tear them down so quickly without putting something in return so that people don't feel like, you know, their house is falling down on them, right? And I think that in this
is why thinkers like you, now you feel there's a revival of old or like, let's say, traditional values again. So you hear like people like Jordan Peterson, for example, now making waves and gathering all this following or all this following, and people like Ryan Holiday, the champion of Stoicism as well, with millions of followers. So because these people are talking about old things, they're not bringing anything new to the table, but they're just like, right, hinting at things that existed from thousands of years. So what do you think about that, about these new like figures emerging?
So I think that I think that they have a point. I think that they are really good at identifying problems, but they're also really good at giving bad solutions to those problems. And I think that what you just said is the key of it. They very often, the solutions that they offer is to go back to something. And this is understandable. If you're in a situation in which you feel like the world is chaotic and you have lost your meanings and you don't know what to do with yourself, the natural thing to do is to go like, well, what was the last thing that worked? Let's just go to the thing that worked before. But I think that this is a somewhat naive way of looking at the world, because history only goes one way. You cannot paddle back history. And, you know, our present day world is different than the world from 50 years ago. And we have technologies that we didn't have that completely transformed our world. We have had social movements that have completely transformed our world. And again, like, think what you may of feminism, but it has completely transformed our world, right? But it's not only this. There's been a lot of like racial justice movements, for example, that have transformed our world. Sure. Decolonization of the world has massively transformed it. The world balance right now is not what it was, right? It's the US is no longer a single dominant power in the world in the same way that it was just 20 years ago. And we cannot just simply go back to stuff that was. I think it's just a bit naive. And I think especially right now, when we're not only experiencing all of those political turmoils, but we're also on the verge of potentially, well, I don't know, creating new life forms. I mean, we're about
another AI revolution, like another technological revolution, which is AI, right? That's what you mean.
Exactly. So if we end up really creating something as powerful as, you know, some people think we could in there, it will massively transform the world and it will completely change the way we assign meaning. And here's an example for you how to do that. So for example, a lot of people who talk about return to traditional values, part of what they mean is return to a value in which, for example, men were the providers of a household, right?
But this can no longer work today. I mean, most women work, right? And are contributors, so. Yeah,
exactly. So on one hand, this is already difficult because women will just not want this. So that's one thing. But even if you could do something like this, you know, perhaps in 10 years' time, most of the jobs will be done by AIs anyway.
I see what you mean.
And like the source of your meaning as a human, if the source of your meaning in life as a human is how well you can perform a job or work or provide for someone, and you find yourself in a world in which most jobs are done by AIs and humans are just not needed for it, well, then you're screwed, right? Because you decide your entire life's meaning with something that's just not needed anymore.
So the solution must incorporate the circumstances of the time. That's what you're saying.
Exactly, right.
Based on your work, I know you've done a lot of work in that field. What are some tools or strategies that you recommend to address this meaning crisis and to give someone's life meaning?
Right. Well, I think that one of those things really is to try and understand what are your options, right? So like I said, you know, we have this infinity of options, or maybe you like have some people who go like, here is this one or two or three meanings that you should follow and that's it. But really, there are some tools that you can use that allow you to actually assess and limit, you know, the number of options, but also go beyond just the several things that some other people are trying to push on you. So I think philosophy is absolutely the best thing to do. And yes, you can start from studying Stoic philosophy. I think that it's really nice that people are coming back to it. But this is by no means the only philosophy that has been out there, right?
For sure.
We have
How old is Stoicism? How old is Stoicism?
It's about 2nd century AD when it was really properly kicking off, but it has its roots early as well. But there's so many other schools of philosophy that you could follow, and not all of them from the West. I mentioned Confucianism as well. It's a fantastic source.
Eastern philosophies as well.
Absolutely. And kind of looking at what those people thought about how to create meaning and how to hone your virtues and things like this, how to know yourself, you know, how to find what you're good at, is fantastic. And, you know, there's many things in there that I think a lot of those people who are trying to promote this return to old values could learn from as well. Because one of the main virtues that a lot of those ancients were focusing on was humility. Humility to admit that we don't know everything, that we can always learn, that we can, you know, you should always listen to others and see, because maybe they've got something interesting to say. And I think many people right now kind of failed to do that. But as we do this, is this trying to find this golden middle. And I think that's a great advice for people as well who right now tend to be very focused on going into one extreme or the other extreme and really committing to being, you know, I know, either super woke or super anti-woke or super religious or super anti-religious or something like this. And instead, try to find some golden middle. So for example, you know, try to find some limits to your freedom, but also try to not have too few options, right? Try to not make your life too convenient, but, you know, not also make it too difficult. Try to find a mix between focusing on yourself and focusing on others as well. Try to find, you know, injustices that you can correct, but also, you know, develop yourself and all that.
So balance, like balance in everything.
Exactly. And I think there's one more thing, you know what, we didn't talk about. I just thought about this as I was talking about the finding balance, because I think that another thing that is really making it difficult to find meaning is convenience culture.
What is that exactly?
We have created a culture in which everything is relatively easy for people, right? And we find that this ease is something that we really want to promote. So for example, traveling is much easier than it used to be. Finding entertainment is much easier than it used to be, right? The whole point of dating apps technically was meant to be, you know, to make dating as easy as possible, right? The whole point of having Netflix is so that you can be infinitely amused without ever leaving home. And what we have done in there, I like to talk about by explaining it as the crashing of the value of dopamine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that we have that kind of makes us feel like something is worth pursuing. Something is, that's the thing. We want to do more of that thing. And we have found ways to kind of tap into it that make it super easy to get dopamine. You get lots of little spikes of dopamine when you scroll social media, when you watch, you know, easy things, when you take drugs, when you watch porn and things like that, right? And it used to be that this feeling that we're like really pursuing something that gives meaning to our life, was hard to get.
True. I mean, 20 years ago, we didn't have Netflix, we didn't have the internet, right? So so what you're saying, the dopamine spikes were less frequent then.
Exactly. And you kind of work for it a bit, right? So it felt like in order to actually get the good feeling, the feeling like, I'm on top of things and everything, you had to, put some work in, you had to achieve something. So, you know, right now, I mean, you can take a helicopter to fly up to Kilimanjaro or some other mountain or something like that, and you go like, yes, I conquered the mountain. Amazing. It's not exactly the same as if you, you know, put your boots on and actually walked up, right? And that's what we're doing, I feel. Like, we're getting all of this dopamine the same way as, you know, I mean, social media.
We became addicted probably now to, exactly. to dopamine, right?
it's social media and just a form of drug right now. Yeah.
And how does this like kind of like negate meaning in our life?
Well, exactly.
How does it destroy meaning?
What happens then is that, you know, it's kind of antithetic to the idea of strife and self-improvement and getting something because you worked hard for it. Because you get things for cheap.
Easily.
You
yes.
actively get things for cheap. But what actually, and this is, once again, there's like, if you ask people how happy they are in the moment when they eat a bar of chocolate, they'll go like, yeah, I'm super happy. But when you ask them, you know, 2 weeks later, how happy are you that you've eaten all of this chocolate? They will say, not particularly. And obviously, this is a simple example. But, you know, I think that all of us have the experience of having spent an hour or two scrolling through social media and then going, like, oh, my God, I just wasted an hour of my life. Right? That's exactly it. And I think that in those hours, we could have been doing something that would have given meaning to our lives. But we weren't, because this time was taken away by easy dopamine. Right? And this is why so many people right now, I think, promoting this idea of intentional strife. So this is coming back once again to your question about what we can do to give ourselves a bit of more meaning. And I think this intentional strife is a fantastic thing to do. So, you know, don't take the escalator, take the stairs. Don't take a helicopter up Kilimanjaro, you know, walk up Kilimanjaro. Don't do the hard things for the sake of doing.
Take the road less traveled.
Exactly. So I very much would also recommend people to do that. Try to like give your dopamine more value again. You do it because, you know, get it from things that are not that easy to get. So use social media sparsely, you know, avoid too many, you know, games, films, pornography, whatever. Check out of the attention.
But Simon, this requires, I mean, all this, I mean, makes a lot of sense, but this requires an active effort to do that, because nowadays our environments are built with this convenience within it. So right. So it's going to be hard for people to change. So unless they want to change and then they want to make that explicit effort not to take the easy path, it will not work, correct?
Well, that is very much the point. That is why I think that convenience culture is effectively, I don't want to use the word conspiring against our finding meaning in life, but, you know, it's kind of like it, because it's a flytrap. It's something that is so attractive, seems so nice that you're going to go for it, even though it's not actually good for you. And we know that people are great at doing things that are not good for them, right? I mean, it's not a new thing. You know, we know exactly what is the recipe for healthy life, right? Eat healthy and exercise. I mean, it's not rocket science.
These are hard things to do.
And they're hard things to do. And obviously, if you create a society which makes it harder because it gives you everything, you know, all this easy, convenient enjoyment without having to work for it, then it just teaches people that they don't need to work for anything.
Is this why as well we hear the tale of many people who were born in rich families or who had everything in life committing suicide suddenly because they say, oh, we're not happy, we don't have meaning in life, because they have everything already there, like conveniently present in their lives? Is this kind of a similar concept?
I think it's very closely related, yes. People find meaning in struggle. People find meaning in getting something despite the fact that there were obstacles.
I see. Simon, one question about the concept of discovery or creation. Do you also think that living a meaningful life is more about discovery or creation? Like people who create something are probably live a more meaningful and happy life. Let's say, I don't know, artists, for example, or people who come up with something new, basically like finding meaning in something that is already in your life versus, you know, like creating a company, let's say, this will give you meaning for sure, right? But you know, in the simple thing in my life, if I reassess what I already have and I try to find meaning in them, that's also something that anybody can do. So you think both are rewarding ways to find meaning?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's 8 billion people in the world and there's 8 billion ways of finding meaning in your life. And I know that I've been talking already before about having too much freedom and all this. But realistically, what I'm trying to say is that there is no point at all in trying to say that one way is better than the other. I mean, of course, yes, there will be some criteria for that. If what gives you meaning in life is, I don't know, killing puppies, then probably is. It's not a great meaning in life, right? But assuming that what you're doing is not immoral and helps others and all this, I don't see a reason why we should say that some are, I don't know, look down, you know, at some people's meanings. I think it's fantastic if people find whatever works for them.
I see. Well, it was a great and interesting discussion, Simon. I would like to learn more a little bit, or maybe our listeners would like to learn more about you. So where would they go to learn more about your work and what you do?
Sure. I have a blog and a website where you can find me. So that's simonfocht.org. So it's just my name.org. I post written posts in there, and I also link to my YouTube channel where I have some videos. I've been focusing on various topics related to self-improvement and masculinity in particular. So it's kind of more aimed for men. But I'm about to start branching out a little bit more. If you're interested, I would definitely point you to my website and my YouTube channel.
For sure. I will. Your links will be mentioned in the description of our video, so our listeners can also directly visit your social accounts and YouTube channel from that. And you said you're going to branch out soon into another area. Is this still confidential, or you can talk a bit about it?
I can talk a little bit about this. I was thinking about focusing a little bit more on more general kind of life and self-improvement, and creating some courses that would work with. I'm also writing some more structured, longer pieces, perhaps. And you mentioned that I'm an academic, I'm a philosopher. I've been doing a lot of all of this work in the academia before. And I have now, a couple of years ago, decided to branch out a little bit and, let's say, do this what I call philosophical activism. So taking philosophical ideas and bringing them to people a little bit more, and trying to help people live their lives, live better lives, thanks to these sort of concepts. And I'm trying to also look into the possibility of creating some interesting courses that people could do that would help them apply some of those ideas in their everyday life. Because like we mentioned, a lot of the time when you talk about those things, it seems easy, in the same way as, I don't know, living a healthy life is easy. Just, you know, eat healthily and exercise. It's easy in theory, but it's very difficult in practice. And having some sort of guidance, some sort of tips, potentially coming from this philosophy that I've been talking about, might be useful for people. So that's why I wanted to also construct some courses on that topic.
Great. Well, all that sounds very exciting, and I wish you the best of luck in your future projects. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today, Dr. Simon, thank you very much for enlightening us on the topic of how to live a more meaningful life. I'd like maybe in the future to talk again about other topics. I've always been an enthusiast about philosophy, so great. Thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to that. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.